Welcome to Bombshell. This is Erin Simpson.
This is Radha Iyengar.
And this is Lauren DeYoung-Shulman.
And we have a very special Manniversary episode for all of you.
For he's a jolly good fellow.
So we have been doing this for 1 year, ladies.
We sure have.
And to mark the occasion, we're going to talk to some men.
If we must.
Do you think anybody noticed that we haven't done that in the last year?
I think they might have.
It's just really hard to find men who are national security experts. Actually, if people have recommendations.
We actually called, but they were never available.
Right. If they could send us a list, but we would lose it. And then
maybe
if you could
a
send
binder.
Us another list.
Oh, they could moderate a panel maybe.
Yeah, that'd be great. So today we're going to talk to three of our biggest fans. First up, and I really can't tell you how excited we are about this, Kai Rizdal from Marketplace is going to join us.
To literally squeal.
I literally fainted right now.
After that, Frank Gavin is going to join us and talk about keeping up foreign relations. And then Ben Wittes from the Lawfare blog and Brookings is going to talk about White House mayhem.
So we brought on, if you have any male Twitter or actual national security crushes, we're bringing them to the table. I guess that's fine for a one-time thing.
One time. One night only.
And we are taking advice from the rational security folks and adopting the actual day, not evening drinking.
Day drinking.
Not even late afternoon drinking.
Just for our listeners, we've started rather early today. What are we drinking, Radha? What did you find in a corner shop?
First of all, I'd just like to note that although I am recording this in person with you guys, it is actually 3 hours earlier for my body. So I'm really taking one for the team here. And we are drinking a pink rosé sparkling wine from Napa.
I think it's from 7-Eleven, but whatever whatever you say.
Napa via the liquor store down the street.
Perfect. Perfect. We're very excited about that. Well, before we get to our hilarious and amazing guests, we have a few items of interest we want to knock off and just bring our listeners up to speed on. Lauren, what's first?
So first, Vice President Mike Pence is on a lovely tour of the Middle East, for which most of us are wondering, why on earth did he go?
He was supposed to go in December and then canceled it, and now he is in fact in the region.
So he managed to take off like right in the middle of a government shutdown, which is sort of ixnay on the traveling during government shutdown. A went to Israel after we told Israel we were going to let them chill after our announcement of moving the embassy to Jerusalem. Went to Egypt, didn't so much talk about human rights or anything we might actually care about from a policy perspective, and went to Jordan for what Radha calls the Love Actually moment.
With the public chastisement of America for, you know, making changes without consulting anyone to our embassy, our location of our consulate in Israel.
Yeah, it's really great when one of your strongest allies in the region just wants to dress you down on the carpet in front of, you know, everybody else.
Literally everyone. But speaking of the Middle East, Secretary Tillerson made a speech that not really anyone paid attention to last week.
It did not make a lot of news.
But should have.
So he was out at Stanford at the Hoover Institute being interviewed by none other than Condoleezza Rice. Who, if we recall, about a year ago, got him his job. So that's kind of interesting to remember. And he basically announced a second or 10th front in the forever war, that we were going to have an indefinite presence in Syria.
Here's the thing. I don't get you guys. What is the legal authority we have to be there?
Oh, my God.
So like, that was legal schmiegel. God.
Like, he's not even like pretending we're there to kill terrorists.
We're over legal authorities, Lauren.
I mean, we
do what we want. You're not the boss of me.
I just hear my niece's voice when I could do what I want. Maybe the Congress is going to come around to this. There was some talk in the fall about a new authorization of the use of military force. But like the administration at no point was like, we're going to have Secretary Tillerson roll out our forward-looking Syria policy. Also, FYI, why is the State Department rolling out the military force posture in Syria?
Right.
They certainly didn't go to Congress and say, hey, what would you like? We would like you to do X, Y, and Z in support of our rollout plan. I mean, as far as I can tell, maybe there was a hearing or two that I missed, but like,
it seems unlikely.
Mattis has been over there briefing on the National Defense Strategy, over there briefing on the National Nuclear Posture Review. We have not seen a serious strategy or even like some sort of CENTCOM. They haven't
strategy,
hauled Botel.
Strategy. It's a brave new world. We don't need no strategy.
Well, Radha, you're kind of punchy this morning or afternoon or whatever day it is.
Pink rosé in the morning will do that to you.
So maybe you should head over to Davos and have dinner with all the globalists.
That's right. Well,
plutocrats.
as long as I get to tell them why my national agenda is the best agenda, the most smartest agenda
ever. Are you open for business?
I'm always open for business.
Right.
That sounds terrible.
That sounds terrible.
Never say that. But no, interestingly enough, Trump going to Davos is a interesting choice of, I guess, a reverse Love Actually moment, where we're going to go to talk to a bunch of globalists and tell them how we don't need their stupid globalism, except could they please, pretty please, come to America for business and invest in us because we're pretty, oh, so pretty. And, you know, I think it's a little bit of a double-edged sword here, where he wants to engage with the globalists to have international investment from their end, but
on our terms.
Right.
Right. We're open for business unless you're selling dishwashers or solar panels, in which case we'd like to slap a massive tariff on those.
I think if I could describe our Davos policy, it would be a word that Aaron would probably censor out. So I'll just say it's hate sexing Davos.
Yes. Yes. Marry, screw, kill. We could have a whole effort around that. Anywho, maybe one of the norms that this administration could break would be to not go to Davos anymore and have that whole situation just kind of fall apart. It seems like a weird...
Well, I'm hearing that it's really fun for all the staff who have to go to support the trip.
Yeah, they like have to triple bunk and more or less stay about 3.5 hours away from Davos itself, because the U.S. government never manages to book a hotel close enough to actually be close to the summit site. It's a joy for everyone involved.
Well, there is also going to be a meeting between President Trump and Prime Minister Theresa May from Great Britain, and there could be some interesting implications or fallout from that. He was supposed to make a trip to England that got canceled because they couldn't promise, quote, good coverage or a warm reception. And
I think they could promise literally neither of those things.
That's right. That's right.
There would be coverage and reception.
Right. But not
adjectives are tough, guys.
Right. That's
adjectives
right. are tough. That's right. So we'll see. We'll see in a couple of weeks kind of what the if there's any additional fallout from Pence's trip. There's any additional fallout from Davos, whether our serious strategy survives contact.
Right. Air quote strategy.
Air quote strategy. You know, it is funny. So basically, like, the day after Tillerson announced the strategy for Syria, Secretary Mattis was over at SICE releasing the National Defense Strategy.
Yep.
Where we were told that it's all about great power competition and we're done with the small wars. Except for...
Maybe they didn't talk to one another.
Our ongoing, our permanent presence in Syria and another 1,000 troops possibly for Afghanistan.
Exactly. Have you guys seen the meme of the guy who's walking with his girlfriend and going to check out the other girl as the new defense strategy? I think it's perfect. Is that the current girlfriend is counterterrorism. The hot chick is great powers. It's the perfect analogy for a national defense strategy. Way better than like a Michelin Man or whatever the hell we had
in the past.
It's
cool. We're going to build all the nukes. And we're going to have all the nukes. We're not actually going to fund the department that maintains the nukes or hire any of the
people.
Well,
we might.
That's...
Question mark.
Exclamation point.
You mean the Department of Energy.
I
just
do.
To be clear.
I mean the... And it's semi-autonomous substructure, the National Nuclear Security Administration, NNSA, Frank Klotz, former General Klotz, Administrator Klotz, just stepped down after serving for a year in this administration as sort of a carryover from the Obama administration and managing that process, and had some pretty strong words on how we are basically at capacity. And the current plans and discussions assume both an improved infrastructure, which the current infrastructure not only needs to be fixed, but then expanded to support, and a bunch of people to work.
Yeah, the workforce issues are pretty interesting across the board.
Especially when recruitment and retention are just way super duper down.
We don't make a lot of nuclear engineers.
We don't. And it turns out that when you need them, you can't just magic them into existence. You need to train them and bring them in through the process and train them up.
Man, if process wasn't already our Valentine, I'd say personnel and readiness would be our Valentine.
I would just say that in addition to the NNSA having this, there is, of course, USAID's process is not their Valentine either.
Oh, yeah. They have rejected the State Department process, right? They're not going to support.
Completely.
They quit.
New phone, who dis?
Excellent. Well, we'll leave collective opinions of USAID and other departments aside.
I just think we've got a lot of 2018 to look forward to.
We really, really do. And three excellent guests. So For our first segment of our very special Maniversary episode, we have none other than Kai Rizdahl of Marketplace. Kai, thanks for joining us.
Could not be happier, honestly. It's such a treat.
Now, we'll have a chance maybe to talk about this a little bit, but I should say for our listeners that you have a much more interesting biography than maybe your average NPR host. Not that, one, you work actually for NPR, or two, that NPR hosts aren't interesting, but you were a naval aviator?
Yeah, so I spent 8 years in the Navy flying E-2Cs off the Theodore Roosevelt in the fleet, and then a couple of years on the Joint Staff. And then you'd be in foreign service. Yeah, I did 4 years in the Foreign Service. I wanted to keep going overseas on the government's dime, but I didn't want to go to actual sea for, you know, 6 or 8 months at a time.
Well, that's, you know, I think pretty interesting, and we're going to have a chance, I hope, to dig into a little of that. But before we get into serious stuff, we have our new set of bombshell questions.
Those are serious in their own way.
Do you want to kick us off?
They're very good personality indicators. So our very first bombshell question for you, Kai, is what is your entrance music? And you have technical entrance music, so you can't actually use that. So what would your choice of entrance music be?
So that's funny, because my first thought was, oh, the Marketplace music. But that's a cop-out, so I'm not going to do that. So I actually went with Empire State of Mind by Jay-Z and Alicia Keys. Yeah. It's when I need to fire myself up to get writing or to do stuff, I throw that on really loud, and it gets me going. So that's what I'm going with.
All right. Next question. What is your most quoted movie line?
Lighten up, Francis. Right? I mean, come on.
Do kids these days get that? Do your kids know that movie reference?
I say it to my kids, and they look, and honestly, I mean, you know, I say it to my 19-year-old, and he's been hearing me say it for like 20 years, and he looks at me and goes, Dad, wait, what? So
that's from Stripes, in case anybody was wondering.
Yes.
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 PME for the day.
What book does everyone else love but you can't stand?
Anything by Jonathan Franzen. Anything.
Wow.
That struck a nerve.
I read The Corrections when I was in Afghanistan, and I came home right before Thanksgiving, and I was like, wow, I really love Jonathan Franzen. But it turns out I just love The Corrections, because he's talking about this semi-dysfunctional Miss Western family, which maybe was, you know, relevant
stuck
to my experience.
So it's funny you mentioned The Corrections, because that's how I first came to read Jonathan Franzen. I had him on Marketplace talking about The Corrections, because it's about work and society and stuff like that. And we said, sure, we'll talk about it. And he was an interesting interview, but my God, did I hate that book.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Well, the rest of them had some challenges as well. I did not love Freedom, to be sure. So, okay, Kai, what is your favorite bar in the world?
So I need to beg off this one, because I don't go to a lot of bars, because I just don't. But let me take you back to when I was in my younger days. And it's not just my favorite bar, but my favorite hamburger and my favorite place to have a beer, which is on the beach in Pensacola Beach when you're in flight school, watching the Blue Angels in their springtime practices.
It's a pretty good answer.
Yeah,
that
we'll
sounds good.
We'll allow it. We'll allow it. Yeah. Excellent.
All right. Now, what is the best use of a statistic or data that you've ever seen? This should be a good one.
So I have two, actually. One is in honor of y'all, and then the other one is in my regular life. I really just love CEP, circular error probable. I truly love the idea that we're going to measure munitions by, well, you know, if 50% of them get in this circle, everything's going to be all right. And I just, I love that.
That's amazing. That's great.
Yeah. The other one is, just to get a little wonky here, the fact that the unemployment report, when it comes out every month, actually has a margin of error. It has a confidence interval. And the 90% confidence interval on the unemployment report every month, the most recent month, January, was 120,000 jobs. Now, when you think about the fact that the economy added 148,000 jobs last month, and the margin of error is 120,000, I just think it's fascinating. We're trying to measure this economy down to a gnat's ass.
Kind of a noisy measure.
Yeah.
It's why that's the unemployment measure has a lot of problems.
That's right.
But that's a whole different kind
of podcast. We'll leave that for a separate discussion.
Yeah, do you remember trying to do that in Afghanistan, Radha?
I sure did. That was fun for the whole family.
It really was. It was great. We don't do that anymore. So Kai, one of the things we wanted to talk to you about was, in general, kind of what it's like being in the media, and in particular, you know, Marketplace covers some really complex stories, some of which are really fast moving, some of which are like the definition of slow moving, almost kind of tsunami like stories. And so if you could just talk to us a little bit about how you try to both you yourself understand those, but also build a team that can bring all that information together and disseminate it to the listeners in a way that's, you know, as we try to do here sometimes, you know, gets all the nuances but doesn't bore anybody and kind of thread that needle.
Yeah. So the first thing you need to understand about, I guess, me and Marketplace as I interpret it to listeners, is that I'm a history and political science guy. I'm a national security guy, right? I was a history guy coming out of college. I spent time in the national security establishment. I got my master's degree in national security. And it's really a fluke that I wound up doing business and economic news. So this is not an inherently interesting topic to me, even though it matters deeply in this society. So what I have to do every single day when we do the program and as we think about it in our morning editorial meetings is make it interesting to me and to the layperson, because this stuff, as we saw in the crisis that started 10 years ago, by the way, this year, this stuff matters if you don't understand it. It matters in a different way than straight up national security stuff. But the black box that is the American economy really matters if you don't understand it. So how do we engineer that? Well, first of all, it's about the storytelling, right? It's about making people want to listen to things that are just not inherently gripping news, right? I mean, unemployment report, that's not inherently something that's going to make somebody say, ooh, wait, can't wait to hear Marketplace tonight because, oh boy, you know, the jobs report came out today, right? But it matters. And so we need to be able to explain it to people in a way that they want to listen. How do we do that? We find characters. We use our style, which has been honed over, you know, 30 years. We use my personality, honestly, to make people want to pay attention. And then we go with the best we got. We take our best reporters, we take our best editors, and we put them on the stories that matter, that really have to break through all the noise. Because as you all know, the news environment today is noisy, and we need to you know, be better than the noise.
It's definitely one of the things we struggle with. We remind people all the time that we're not a breaking news program because we just don't have the resources to stop or, you know, reset things. But it is a balance between, you know, what's hot this week and do we even remember what happened last week as we try to provide that context.
totally.
And I want to key off something you said. As an economist who doesn't actually study economic stuff, this really resonates with me because fundamentally a lot of economic stuff is both really important and extraordinarily just tremendously boring. So what do you think the role of both economists and economics is in, as we think about these sort of like current events, national security issues, as a national security guy who's come the other way to the business and economics side?
You know, so it's really interesting. So, you know, the president gave this national security speech in December, and he talked about, you know, trade and economics as a key part of national security. And that's great coming from, you know, a politician whose job it is to sort of bring all these together with whatever degree of skill the incumbent has. But I thought it was interesting the other day when Secretary Mattis said, listen, there is no greater threat to what the Department of Defense does, and I don't want to isolate national security just to the Pentagon, but in this instance, Mattis said, listen, there's no greater threat to the instability that the congressional ineptitude, he didn't use that word, congressional ineptitude on the budgetary process has.
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who stands back for a second and looks at the way not just the global environment works, but also here in the United States. Anybody who steps back and doesn't understand that use of force national security and economic force national security are inherently intertwined, maybe they need to listen to Marketplace more. I don't know. It seems so elemental to me.
We just said we aren't a breaking news story, or we're not going to break news here, but there were new tariffs announced this week, and I haven't had a chance to listen to you guys this week, but you know, how do you see some of this? And Rod has really highlighted this kind of the America First and the way that's going to play out in a more nationalistic as opposed to you know, liberal international order sort of way. Do you see that playing out on the domestic economic side as well, or? You know,
So let me take that question and I'll turn it two ways. The first thing is, to lost in the tariffs this week was the news that the TPP nations, the Trans-Pacific Partnership nations, have come to an agreement
without
us. They've come to an agreement without us. And so we now have a gaping crater of a void in our trade participation in the Pacific sphere. And that, to me, is deeply, deeply problematical. And the fact that people in positions of power in the national security establishment on both the economic and military traditional side don't see that or can't get the president to realize that is troubling. On the issue of the tariffs specifically, look, this is a global economy. And as much as the president wants to talk about pulling up the drawbridge and getting rid of NAFTA and tariffs, and you have to pay NATO nations because you owe us, even though we know we really they don't owe us, that's not going to fly. In the long, oh my God, listen to me. In the long arc of history, right? That is not going to fly. And we will eventually return to some kind of closer to baseline normal because, and here's the catch, market forces are going to drive us that way. That's going to happen, right? And no matter how any politician tries, the market doesn't care what politicians do.
Okay, now we really have to get serious and ask you, what is your hottest take?
Oh, wow. Okay, so let me get serious here for a minute, actually, because this will, I think, resonate with you all and your listeners, but also it's something that I've felt since the day I got out of the service, right? I am and continue to be so deeply distressed. And I know this isn't a take. This is me just ranting, and I apologize for that.
What is a hot take, but a rant? No.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Press on.
I am so deeply distressed by the civilian-military divide in this country and by the fact that there is a lack of understanding of what people in the national security establishment and in uniform do in our names as sacrifices they make, and the fact that because it's an all-volunteer force, it is somehow seen as disposable. The fact that there is not an appreciation at the very highest levels of government for the sacrifices that people in the national security establishment make, whether it is the Foreign Service in all hell and gone, whatever, you know, place you want to be, or people in the military service. That to me is just, it is the defining divide in this country for the past, well, let's see, 2001. So 17 years.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, we're all just nodding along here. So.
We've got our lighters out. Yeah. We're right. Very
the
much
choir,
you know.
Singing.
All right. Do you have a question for us?
You know, I do. And I would love to hear the three of you, and at whatever length you'd care to discourse on this, answer this question. Do you believe whether this current administration lasts another 3 years or another 7 years, that the norms of your chosen professions specifically, the norms will ever be reestablished or something close to it?
So I'll start first. And I think they can be reestablished, but I don't think it will happen through natural order. And let me preface that by saying the biggest norm that I think has decayed over time and just gone to all hell in this administration is the relevance of facts for policy discussion, evidence and facts.
Yeah.
And I think
that
is basically doesn't exist at this point. And it's a real concern in how it influences policy, but also that there seems to be this notion that there is your facts and my facts and not just a set of evidence. And I think there is opportunity to try to return us to a world in which people believe in facts, and then we have different sort of preferences or policy ideals or whatever. But that's going to take some work and, frankly, some politicians acting more in good faith than in sort of partisan interests. And I don't see that happening in the near term.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I'll buy that.
So something that I've been working on here at CNES, there's a Twitter account by the name of, I can't believe I said, there's a Twitter account. There's a person by the name of Amy Siskind who has a Twitter account where she weekly documents the kind of the changes that have gone on in American day-to-day life as a result of the Trump administration. And that's something that a lot of us have been talking about in the national security world, not just the less reliance on alliances and the changes in trade policy, but the day-to-day, how do you do bilateral meetings? How do you pre-brief the president? How do you rotate people to the National Security Council? The basics of how we do our profession and how those are deteriorating in a lot of ways. And we've been thinking about how do we document that, but also it's such an amazing opportunity to rebuild. Like the way that we have National Security Council meetings is really stupid, frankly, in the last several administrations. So can we rethink how do you do that in a way that actually takes into account the different kinds of expertise that you need to access, the real-time information, the need for transparency with the American people? Can you rebuild national security institutions in a way that really does service better And I think that's an agenda that those in the national security profession need to take on, regardless of who's president. This president's tearing a lot of that down.
Yeah. So just as a follow up, then, do you think, I mean, that's going to add to the workload of whoever is POTUS 46, right?
Yeah. POTUS 46 is in a world of hurt.
Yeah.
In probably a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like POTUS 46 needs to be just like the blandest, most like plus inconsequential lump of coal.
I was going to say, it's consistent with this view that roughly when they give women senior executive positions, they give them failing
when
companies.
When we're already screwed up.
So we'll just try that.
That's
you
totally
know,
right.
U.S. Yep. government style. Yep.
I mean, I think, you know, my perspective on this is maybe, I think Lauren's right that there are some opportunities. There are some norms that have ossified or calcified, and we might be able to break a little bit of China. That takes my most optimistic moment to get to that spot, I think. You know, but in general, you know, you don't, you know, I used to do a lot of work related to like post-war reconstruction and, you know, how you recover after, you know, large-scale violence. And there's no reasserting the status quo ante, right? So there's no point at which we go back to June of 2016, right? Everything we do is in the post phase, is in the post-Trump phase. And so it's only a question of what you can do with the institutions and the individuals and the resources that you have at time zero, not at what you might have had in the alternate future at T-minus 10. And I think that's, you know, I watch military planners make this mistake all the time. I watch State Department or USAID planners make, well, to the extent they have them, make that mistake all the time. You know, but you have, it's not about just pushing a reset button. It's about recognizing what the actual contours, political and social and otherwise, are and moving out from there. And that's going to be hard because I think there's actually a lot of fissures, you know, some of which you highlighted, Kai, but there's a lot of other pieces. You know, with, there's an economy that needs to work for a lot more people than it's currently working for.
Yep, absolutely.
And if it doesn't, I don't know. There's a whole lot of other conversations we'll never get to. So we don't want to take up too much of your time, but thank you so much for joining us.
It's such a treat. Honestly, I'm so thrilled to be able to have done this.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Now, to keep up some foreign relations with our next Maniversary guest, we have Professor Frank Gavin. He's the director of the Kissinger Center at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. That is much too long a title.
It's a mouthful.
We're just going to call him Bad Frank.
Yeah, it turns out day drinking brings out
the evil side.
I'm trying my best after having only one sip to keep good Frank here and bad Frank in check, but we'll see how this goes.
You are an Eagles fan, so there's only so much we're going to be able to do with this, I feel like.
Yes, you may have seen films of me climbing up greased poles in Philadelphia on Sunday. I will neither confirm nor deny that I may or may not have punched a Philadelphia horse, cop horse. There's a variety of things that Joel Embiid and I will keep to our graves.
So this is our, so Joel Embiid is of course a great Kansas Jayhawk, and Joel Embiid's
trust the process
catchphrase is trust the process. So if anybody knows how to get Joel Embiid a tote bag or a t-shirt, we very much would like to send him a process as my Valentine.
I'm working on it. He may be the next Kissinger Center chair. It's an intricate recruitment process. I've got Sam Hinkie helping us out, but I'm hopeful to bring Joel Embiid to the Kissinger Center.
All right, we're not going to ask Frank the full slate of bombshell questions, but we would like him to tell us what his favorite movie quote is. Or his most used movie quote.
So, as Aaron knows, one of my favorite movies is Miller's Crossing. There's something that perfectly describes my Irish Catholic background, and it's absolutely perfect that it's a Coen Brothers movie who are not Irish Catholics, and it gets it perfectly. And there's any number of quotes to pick from, but I think perhaps my favorite is when the Gabriel Byrne character is talking to his star-crossed lover, for a late night rendezvous. And she says, you know why you're here. And he says, why? And she says, for the oldest reason in the book. And he says, there are friendlier places to get a drink than here. So I think that's my favorite movie line.
That's good. It does sum you up pretty nicely. So so we've already kept up a little bit of foreign relations in our intro segment. We want to kind of ask Frank some of the big picture questions. Radha, you want to kick us off there?
Well, let's start super big picture, which is what national security issue or topic did we used to talk about all the time, but we don't really talk about anymore?
Sure. That's a great question. First of all, for anything, congratulations. What a wonderful accomplishment you guys have done. This is a As Aaron knows, I'm not a big podcast person, and yours is the only podcast I actually listen to.
Well, thank you.
It's absolutely terrific. So congratulations. I think that one of the interesting things about this year is I think that if you had asked me this last year, I would have said, well, we don't talk about nuclear weapons very much anymore. And given that that's one of the businesses I'm in, Donald Trump has been good for business. And to a certain extent, one would prefer never to talk about nuclear weapons and hope that the issue would go away. I do think that much of Trump's rhetoric and even some of his policies have brought back the debate and discussion about very important questions that we thought we had settled 50 years ago and, in fact, are open and live right now. And, of course...
What are some of those questions, Frank?
So I think was this assumption, I think, in the world that many of us grew up with, that after a certain point, nuclear weapons, since they eliminated the possibility of great power war, they sort of receded to the background. They really weren't a factor in most of the things we care about in international relations, whether it was civil wars, humanitarian issues, insurgencies. But I think now with the U.S. and Trump administration threats against North Korea's programs, there's all sorts of questions about how do nuclear weapons affect state behavior? Is it possible to prevent a state from getting nuclear weapons, from getting them? Are they actually stabilizing the international politics or not? If you are trying to convince your friends and allies that they shouldn't worry about this, what are the policies that you should pursue to do that? Again, questions that were kind of very old-fashioned, very 60s and 70s, which I think are very much live again.
And a lot of the answers to those, or some of the answers to those, we've found in history, right? I mean, this sort of fundamental question of does nuclear deterrence work depends a lot on your interpretation of... A lot of people, I think, go back to the Cuban Missile Crisis. You've written a lot about the Berlin Crisis as kind of the driving dynamic in the 50s and 60s. You're actually a historian by training. And so I wonder if that provides you with the context. You know, what does history give us to work with today? What does history provide us as a tool or as an approach to answer some of these questions?
So great question. I sort of would divide my answer in two, one on nuclear weapons and one more broadly. On nuclear weapons, I often like to call myself a historian of something that never happened, thermonuclear war. And so given that historians can't agree on the things that did happen, such as why the First World War happened, the methodological issues surrounding the effect nuclear weapons have on international relations is really, really hard to get at. So the first thing I think history reminds you of is to take some humility. For example, North Korea.
You're known as a very humble person.
I am. I think that's
good lesson.
If you look at my family crest, there's sort of humility, goodwill, get along with everybody.
Functional alcoholism.
Exactly.
I mean, yeah, it's
all
great.
These good things. So yes, humility is my middle name. But I think, for example, all of our good friend Vipin Narang, who knows more about this stuff than anybody, has said a lot about, well, you know, nuclear weapons, the North Koreans obviously only want them as invasion insurance. Well, how do we know that, right? I could argue the case that, in fact, there are plenty of examples in history where nuclear weapons provide a smaller power with all sorts of incentives to act coercively, to engage in brinkmanship. There's all sorts of reasons to believe that North Korea wants to unify with South Korea, that they actually have aggressive intentions. The fact is, this is a very difficult question to answer because the only way you can answer it is after a thermonuclear war, which, please God, never happened. But we have no real observations. We can't actually measure anything. The N is zero, and we want to keep it that way. But I think one of the things that Trump's, let's call what it is, his reckless rhetoric and the aggressive policies of the administration have highlighted is that some of these questions... which we thought were resolved, are at least worth discussing again. Not to say that the Trump administration is right, but the theories that we thought were right actually don't. You can argue the history either way.
So I'm going to interrupt this serious line of questioning with a question we didn't prepare you for, but it's something that all of our male listeners, really all of our listeners, worry about a lot. And that is, how do you think your wardrobe has impacted the success of your national security career?
So I would say that I have, to the extent I've succeeded, it has been despite my wardrobe. I think that if you were to listen to my daughters, they always are fascinated that anyone would listen to me whatsoever, or that I would have any authority whatsoever given what I wear. When I was commuting here last year and there was a particularly cold day and I didn't have a hat, I went into the CVS over in DuPont Circle, and the only winter hat they had was this giant hat with giant pom-poms on it. So I've just worn it everywhere.
That's amazing.
And
it's a total dad move.
No, and I've even gotten to the point where I want to start wearing it to important meetings, and just it's a good look, and it gets my hair in the right place, and it drives my daughters crazy. So yeah, no, the wardrobe thing.
You nailed it.
Yeah, anything that's happened good to me has been despite that.
So you had said that you had some questions for us.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting for me, you guys have extraordinary background in national security. You've done all these great things. You're in touch with all sorts of stuff through this podcast. As a historian coming to DC and being here for a year, the one of the things that's been most striking is how freaked out everybody is, right? And so I guess I would love to know how you all have been processing this year and how you've been thinking about it. Obviously, it was probably a month-to-month thing. One of the things I think this year has shown is that time has been compressed. And particularly those who were in the previous administration, it's got to be particularly jarring how both you make sense of it and what it's done to your time horizons and how you cope.
So as many of our listeners know, I had a baby not that long ago. So I actually, thank you, spent the entirety 2017, we found out I was pregnant like a week after inauguration, sober, like totally sober the whole
time,
every day. it was a really long
whenever
year.
Whenever we asked what are we drinking, it was mostly just me and Lauren who were drinking.
I know. Then there was a lot of wistful sighing. But so I say that to say I had to come to some terms with reckoning with the Brave New World Order, totally sober and couldn't. My liver probably thanks me. But I think in some ways I have become less freaked out and more like deeply sad. Which I'm not sure is going to be that helpful, but now that I can drink again, I mean, but I think that the way in which this administration has sort of really made truly patriotic civil servants and the true institutions that run our country, whatever your politics, whatever you think about the policies, just the total enemy of the American public is it's so sad, and it's not reversible, and it's not changeable in a short period of time, which means even when we in 3 or 7 years change presidents, we're not necessarily gonna be able to win back the American public's trust and support, and frankly not going to be able to maintain the inflow of people we need committed to public service to do that when they're the enemy of America. So
I have something of an opposite take from Radha in that after the seven stages of grief moved on, I and several others talked about the fact that this has been one of the most professionally rewarding years of my career, in that I had to force myself to do things that I hadn't planned to do. I thought I would be on a totally different career path at this point in time. This podcast, the writing I've been able to do, the work I've done at CNAS. And then to Radha's point, though, this work that we do reminding the American people of why public service is important and why the basics of national security should matter to them day to day. I didn't have that passion two years ago. It was a job. I loved it, but it was not something that I felt I had to justify in any way. Now feeling like I have to justify it constantly and explain why this matters, not only to our big nerdy crowd, but also to my parents in Texas and elsewhere, has taken on this entirely new life for my career that I didn't have in 18 months ago. That in 2 years, if there's nuclear Armageddon, that may not matter that much. But at least the last year has been somewhat more interesting than I thought it was going to be.
That's a cheerier version of, yeah.
I mean, I would say, people asked me a year ago, family or friends, like, what should we be doing? And they wanted big picture, big reach sorts of things. My response was like, join a church, join a community group, help with the Girl Scouts, like do something very, very local. Cause I really think at some level, even though I hated all the civil society reading that I had to do in graduate school, there is something about that kind of social capital that does matter. And so the idea that the important things in life are actually happening in your schools and in your neighborhoods and in your direct community, and you know, in kind of tragic ways, that was really brought, I think, to relief for a lot of us at the end of the year, as we went to several funerals and, of course, lost our friend Sean Brimley here at CNAS, that the individuals and friends are kind of what matter. And so the career stuff is really important. And we've all had, you know, Rod and I both have new jobs, you know, this year. I think that's been pretty exciting. And I don't have a good way of coping with the big picture. And so I've gone kind of all the way to the micro, you know, to, you know, make, you know, help everybody, you know, as much as you can for as long as you can, you know, with all that you can. So, you know, that sort of approach.
Well, maybe this could connect to the historian
and
part.
And we'll wrap up with that.
Yeah. So one of the things I was thinking throughout your excellent points was that the thing that has most struck me, or the thing that I think perspective that perhaps I can sometimes bring that is occasionally missing is a longer term perspective. I've been reading A History of Reconstruction, and I can assure you that we have had worse presidents than Donald Trump. Andrew Johnson was a worse president by a considerable amount, and James Buchanan might have been as well. You know, 1969 in New York City, there were over 700 bombings within the city, right? In 1921 in Tulsa, we firebombed an African-American middle-class neighborhood, killing hundreds, while at the same time, tens of thousands of miners were armed in West Virginia fighting. So things can get pretty bad. And historians revel in the unintended, the ironic, the tragic, the uncertain, which brings me to rom-coms. Rom-coms, they're sort of...
Truly.
Yes, they're kind of my...
This is all for you, Radha.
I mean, yeah. I love where this is going already.
Now, they're intellectual porn, right? Because everything works out in the end,
yeah.
Right? And as a historian, nothing ever works out. Everything, all even your best laid plans, right? You know, your Eisenhower, you look at Afghanistan, you say, I'm going to make these people middle class. I'll build a giant dam and they'll have electrification. And what do? They build the world's largest heroin crop, right? That is how historians think. Rom-coms are the one place where you can say, wow, they should have gotten together, life threw them in 90 different directions, and it all worked out perfectly. So I have, when I need to let off steam from reading history, the idea of just watching the two people who are meant to be together clumsily figure out their way through all the kind of historical mess and unintended consequences and end up together is on a very cheap thrill sort of way, very satisfying to me. I am probably one of the few, my guy friends, none of them, they all look at me like I'm crazy, but this is...
Which one's your favorite? You have to tell us.
So I have lots of them, but I generated a bit of controversy when I wrote a piece in July 4th for Ryan that was all centered around La La Land and American Exceptionalism. And where I think the first five, you know, that people either love or hate that movie. And people very close to me who I have great respect for think I'm absolutely crazy. But the first...
Frank, everybody who's really close to me thinks you're absolutely crazy.
Watching the first five-minute scene on the five, the dance scene, was when I first realized that Donald Trump wasn't going to matter. That in the end of the day, there's this great quote when Kissinger meets Lee Kuan Yew, and Kissinger says, do we have to worry about the Chinese? He says, of course you do. There's a billion of them, and they're incredibly smart. They're brilliant. They're going to do a lot of things. But in the end, you don't have to worry because there's 7 billion Americans. And that first 5 minutes of La La Land, where people from every race, background, and creed are all moving towards one dream, as messy as it is, and no one will ever fully get it, to me, that's America. And for all its messiness and nastiness and unpleasantness and, you know, all the bad things that have happened. And so... that rom-com in recent memory for me has been kind of an intellectual vehicle to get through this year.
I'm going to cry, but we're also like maybe 2/3 of the way through our second bottle of champagne right now. So that's probably not unnatural.
I feel like what my takeaway from this is we should be singing and dancing more on this podcast.
Lovely. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
This was delightful.
thank you for having us, and congratulations. You guys are just, am I allowed to say kick ass on a podcast?
Yeah, you're allowed. You sure are. And thank you for the delicious champagne.
Yes. Indeed.
Thank you for having me.
And now moving on to White House mayhem, we have one of the foremost experts in the mayhem of this White House, Ben Wittes, who's with us from Lawfare and the Brookings Institution. Hi, Ben.
Hey.
Good to be here. We're thankful for you and your additional booze. We have lots of bottles of alcohol on the table by this point in the recording process.
I have a new boss that started on Monday, and if she walks by right now, I don't know if I'll have a job later in the day. But
she'll have a bottle of booze. We could just definitely hand one of these off to her. Indeed. I think that would be an excellent offering. So usually we record this in just like one, you know, hour-long setup. We've been here for a couple of hours at this point while we cycle through our Manniversary guests.
Well, I just want to say, you know, as here on behalf of the Rational Security Crew, which is the only other day drinking podcast in Washington that I know of, we felt we owed you guys a bottle. So you have one more.
Excellent.
It will be consumed.
It will be put to
good use.
Don't you worry.
With no doubt. And because you are such a dedicated fan, Ben, we're going to let you kick off with one of the old bombshell questions. What is your favorite statistical distribution?
All right, so I have a trick answer to that question, which is I don't really have one because I don't know any statistics, but I'll tell you a very funny story about Steve Krasner realizing what a fraud I was over statistics. So the first time I gave a presentation at Hoover, I did something I very rarely do, which is I created a PowerPoint presentation. I'm generally allergic to PowerPoint. And I started it with two quotations from my mother. My mother is a mathematical statistician who does biomedical research and designs clinical trials.
But none of that rubbed off.
No. Although I did, as a very young person, I did help her set up her company, which is across the street from Brookings. And I quoted her saying two things that were of relevance to the data that I was presenting. And then I went on to present the data. And the first question is from Steve Krasner, and that is a terrifying experience, by the way.
So you were out at Stanford, and Steve Krasner's a Stanford professor.
Right, and he's sitting there, you know, in his, he's like thinking more great thoughts in an hour while you're talking than you have ever had. And he says, so Ben, that's a really impressive presentation. I really learned a lot. And while you were doing it, I Googled your mother's CV, and it is a really impressive publication list. And so I just wanted to understand, what happened to you? How did you become such a slacker?
Devastating.
Ouch, Charlie.
So that was my, and it, you know, there was this pause moment, because I actually have no advanced degree, and I'm you know, a fraud, actually. And there was this pause moment, and then everybody burst out laughing, and it was fine. And Steve and I have been good friends ever since.
Did he do it as a favor, or
no.
That just a happy accident?
So he was.
Being, I know the answer to this question.
He was being funny, and it was very funny. He was not being mean, and he was his way of expressing that my mother is an extremely impressive statistician, which is true. And it was not wholly unrelated to the event in question, which was, of course, about started with two quotes from my mom.
Well, we're going to make you tell us your entrance music at some later date, I suppose. So, but we would like you to help us walk through, help us stay up to date. Our listeners know that we struggle with keeping score on Le Faire Russe. What's going on with the Russia investigation? This obviously changes by the day. There's a new. Why is Devin Nunes back in the news? Like, I thought we were over this a year ago.
We need to talk about Devin.
I'm really.
I see what you did there. I see.
Yeah. You got that one?
Very apropos. Very, very relevant. Yes. So if you could take whatever starting point you would like. Don't talk too long.
Yeah.
But tell us where we're at in this investigation and remind us again why it matters for national security.
Okay. So I can do this actually in, I think, five sentences. One.
We're going to count.
Nobody knows exactly where we are, but we seem to be reaching a investigative pivot point with respect at least to the obstruction components of the investigation. Number two, reaching that fulcrum point doesn't answer the question what the results of that investigation are going to be. It merely suggests that some body of investigative activity is approaching completion. Number three, the evidence of that is that you tend to interview the most important people last. And over the last few weeks, we have seen interviews with Jim Comey, Jeff Sessions, a bunch of intelligence community leadership, and negotiations for an interview with the president. And that does suggest that things are kind of winding down. Was that three or four?
Roddy, you said you'd count.
That was three. Number four, the fact that the obstruction components of the investigation may be wrapping up in whatever direction they're wrapping up doesn't answer the question of the other components of the investigation. For example, those that deal with collusion or those that deal with possible criminality by people associated with the Trump campaign or organization. And number five, why does it matter? It matters because for two entirely distinct reasons that people tend to conflate. The first is that it very deeply matters whether the president of the United States was elected with some active intervention by a foreign intelligence actor that he in any sense or his campaign in any sense collaborated with in the intervention. That's just inherently a very fraught and upsetting situation that the public is entitled to know, and certainly that the public is entitled to accountability for any crimes that may have been committed in the course of that. Secondly, and separately, the president's interactions with his law enforcement and intelligence apparatus in the course of that investigation have been separate and apart from the merits of the investigation, one of the most appalling and dangerous democratic spectacles we have seen in this country in many, many generations. And a full accounting of the things that the president did in his first year in office that we would universally have understood as an abuse of the intelligence community, an abuse of the law enforcement community, up through January 20th, 2017 is very much in order.
Can we shift gears for a minute? So a lot of, you know, as you know, process is our Valentine around here. And I was struck last week as we were moving into the shutdown and kind of the drama around this meeting at the White House around immigration and DACA. And so there, Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin were like, had come to an agreement and they were bringing a proposal to the president, which they thought that he was going to agree to. They get to the White House. They find that there's an additional set of senators who are opposed to this, who've been brought there by some combination of Stephen Miller and John Kelly. And then you watch the White House sort of whipsaw over the next 72 hours or so as they shift their position on immigration. And most of the finger pointing, at least in the public reporting, seems to point to Chief of Staff John Kelly on that front. And so on the one hand, like, it's annoying in the context of a budget deal. I mean, Chuck Schumer said it's like negotiating with Jell-O. It's like, well, Chuck, why are you negotiating with Jell-O? But that's a separate question.
Jell-O holds its shape. Right. I just want to say, like, that may
it's
be
an unfair allegation
may
against
be
the Jell-O.
A little unfair to Jell-O. Right.
So it's frustrating with regard to the budget negotiations and to DACA. But I was really struck with, like, what if that was happening during a foreign policy crisis? And so I'm wondering, as you've watched this White House, both in the way that they interact with the press, but also deal with some of the Russia investigation and these other policy issues. Do we have a sense? I mean, is there a White House, quote unquote? Like, does the White House do or say anything? Or is it just a series of whims from an individual that are being kind of captured and shaped as best they can by the staff who talked to him last?
Okay, so number one, I am as PNG as it gets, and nobody talks to me. And so I'm kind of making it up here. But
It's fine. You're in very good company on that front.
I mean, you know,
my White House invitations keep getting lost in the mail.
Yeah,
so.
No. I don't.
They loved my transgender report.
Look, I think there are a few things that any foreign intelligence actor thinking about how to influence the White House would be crazy not to notice. The first is that the most important way to get to the president is by getting to Fox News, and specifically Fox and Friends. And you can generate presidential statements in the form of tweets by influencing what the president sees. That's a direct feed into the president. So memo to all the foreign intelligence actors who may be listening to this, if you're not bribing Fox News, Fox and Friends people to convey your messages, you're probably overinvesting in influencing the president. You know, I hate to give advice that may be counter to the national security of the United States, but if I were running a foreign intelligence agency, I would be giving a lot of walking around money to people who can influence, you know, the people who we know on Fox News that he's watching on a daily basis.
Maybe the waiters at Mar-a-Lago.
So let me give you an extreme example of this that happened the other day. So the highest legislative national security priority of this administration, as articulated by all of the people who have testified or given statements about this, was the reauthorization of 702. This is a provision of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that is responsible for, and we can talk about why if you want, it is the single largest contributor to the president's daily brief of all of the authorities in the U.S. government.
So and it allows for some form of domestic surveillance, or at least surveillance of U.S. persons.
No, it is specifically an authority that allows the targeting.
Look, I've been drinking for several hours at this point.
And look, there's a whole industry devoted to making you believing that. So after a few drinks, it's not an accident that they win one. It is authority targeted at non-U.S. persons reasonably believed to be overseas, and sometimes U.S. person communications can get swept up in those acquisitions. This has been a very contentious reauthorization, both because people traditionally on the left have long had civil liberties concerns about 702, and more recently, because people on the right, thanks to Devin Nunes, have joined those on the left in these anxieties. And the result is that it's a very contentious process. The morning that the House was to vote, the president, apparently seeing Fox and Friends suggesting that this authority was used to spy on the Trump campaign, tweeted what appeared to be opposition to reauthorization to 702 in defiance of the position of his own administration. It did not derail the bill, but there were a few hours in there in which the question of whether it would was very much on the minds of everybody who works in this space.
It certainly raises the question of what is the position of, quote, the administration.
Well, so one interesting thing about, you know, conservatism has traditionally been a believer in, a promoter of the idea that the executive is a unitary actor, right? And the entire executive branch is merely delegated authority of the president. And in fact, the president is the executive branch, right? Everybody else is just his fingers. This is the least unitary executive in the history of the country. Mm-hmm. And this is the only executive any of us hopefully will ever live through where the UN ambassador feels free to contradict the president on major issues of policy and gets cheered when she does so, right? So, you know, the president says something crazy and Nikki Haley says, you know, that's not U.S. policy. U.S. policy is X, Y, and Z. And everybody's reaction to that is, thank God for Nikki Haley, right?
Grown-ups in the room phenomenon.
Also, she's at the UN. So why anyone is saying thank God for Nikki Haley in the Republican Party, God knows why.
maybe we could wrap up with this, Ben, which is, as you know, we're all about the hot takes here. So what is your hottest take on White House mayhem issues?
So here's my hot take. Everybody talks about the obstruction component of this investigation as though it's the fundamental question is a criminal question. The fundamental question is not a criminal question. It is an impeachment question. And the relevant...
Which is a political process.
It's a political process inflected by law. And so here's the big question that we're all sitting on right now. We're all actually waiting for an answer to. If this investigation on the obstruction side is wrapping up, does Bob Mueller, A, bring a criminal case, which I think is quite unlikely, B, as Ty Cobb suggests, pack up and go home, or even more extreme, issue a statement clearing the president, which is what, you know, we call him Baghdad Cobb for a reason, but what he seems to think is going to happen. Or C, does he issue a report to Congress which would effectively amount to some form of a data dump of the material that he's collected? And if C, what form does that document take? Is it a public document? Is it a narrative document? Is it a pile of FBI 302s, memoranda of interviews that Congress then does with what it wants? And I think a huge amount of what happens over the next 2 to 3 years actually hinges on the answer to that question.
I actually have a last question, Radha and Aaron, that is really important to all of our male listeners, I know. And that is, do you feel like your hairstyle and your shoes have impacted your career progression in your national security career?
So that's a really interesting question, actually. So I used to have very long hair. I mean, like sort of down here level.
Longer than all of ours, just for the listeners.
And there is actually a picture of me.
Like, we're going to need pictures of this.
Yeah, no, there's actually a picture of me climbing out of the reflecting pool in front of the Capitol.
Were you married to your lovely, charming wife at this point in time?
I was not. We had not yet met. Okay. But we were...
Makes so like, much more sense.
But hang on a second. We were shortly to meet, and we have been married since we were 22. So I was like 17, 18 or 19 at the time. And there's a picture of me climbing out in front of the Capitol with my hair kind of down to here and my pants soaking wet from the reflecting pool. And I still look at that picture. I have it in my office, and it feels to me like actually who I am. And there's this other guy that has this very short cropped hair. I've never given a moment's thought to shoes, but I have thought a lot about hair.
I have three pairs of shoes with me right now, so I can decide what I'm going to wear to the party after we finish recording.
Yeah. So they're all black. I take your question in the spirit in which it's meant. And I think the answer is shoes have not played the remotest role in my professional trajectory. But I have actually spent a lot of time thinking about hair. And I feel fraudulent walking around with my hair this short because it feels like an accommodation that I've made to, I don't know, the man or whatever.
There's still time, Ben. You can grow it out.
You know,
it's not going to increase your chances of getting a White House invitation.
that ship has sailed.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime.
It's been a real, well, only once a year.
I'm once a year is lovely.
Thanks, Ben. Before we go, we don't have time for what's next or pop culture, but I do want to flag. I have like 16 things in my list for pop culture for next week, which include Benedict Cumberbatch as Patrick Melrose, the new Alienist series on television, the new Gianni Versace series on television, and also that we can all now pre-order the third book in the Red Sparrow trilogy, The Kremlin's Candidate. So
now you all know what to prep ahead of next week's episode.
We have a lot to cover. And we'll see you guys soon.